Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. How are you, Kieran?
I'm grand, thank you, Kevin. All is good. Hoping to see a football match this week, but things aren't looking over-promising.
What, who have you got this week?
We've got Wolves on Wednesday, but we've got a few with COVID, and then we're at Old Trafford on Saturday, and United's loads, match is already off midweek, so... wait and see.
Oh well, we really thought we'd put this behind us, Kieran, didn't we? But there we go. Luckily, the people of the world have got a half-baked football finance podcast to keep them going during another crisis. Later in the show, we will be hearing from Tracy Crouch, the ex-minister of sports, MP, of course, who's just published her fan-led review. We spoke to her before it happened and we promised we'd speak to her afterwards, and it was a really, really illuminating interview, as I think you'll agree, Kieran, because you were there.
Yes, I was. Yeah. I love Tracy to bits because she just says it as it is. Yeah, there is no political speech as such. It's she takes the issues and deals with them in a professional and fair manner.
Yeah, and I have to say, Finlay's timing was impeccable because he didn't start barking until we just said goodbye to Tracy.
Well, yeah, we were quite lucky actually, because halfway through the interview, he had an itchy ring and he started rubbing himself on the carpet. But fortunately, that didn't come through the microphone.
It happened to me during one of their early podcasts, Kieran. But I'm a professional broadcaster, so I know how to deal with these things. We have a couple of. Do you know what? I hope Tracy jumps straight to the interview and doesn't listen to the start of this pod. We were all serious all the way through the interview, and now we're talking about your dog's ring. Bye, BAFTA. A couple of news stories, Kieran. The first is that the proposed takeover of Carlisle United is all over.
Yes. This is a very complex situation. Carlisle had borrowed from a company called Edinburgh Woolen Holdings, which subsequently went into administration. It looks as if that debt was bought by another company called Pure Pay Retail, which in turn was owned by a guy called Philip Day, who has historically been on the board at Carlisle United. He was hoping to take over the club. I'd say interesting character. Take a look at his Wikipedia page for his interesting views, such as encouraging is perhaps a very mild way of putting it, people to vote for his daughter to be Miss England, who were employees of his stores. So yeah, very very old sort of patriarchal views. But the supporters' trust at Carlisle are reticent, I think, in certain aspects of this deal. And what we've now had is the current owners, the board, and the supporters trust pointing fingers at each other, and it looks as if the deal has fallen by the wayside. Carlisle are not at the right end of League Two at present, and the owners are saying, well, you know, with the opportunity to potentially rescue the club. To be fair to Philip Day, he has provided funds through sponsorship historically, but it is indicative that communication and transparency are critical in these issues, because we've now got the fans saying we're not quite sure what to believe, who to believe, and the club has not been making money, and you know, it would be a shame if they dropped out of the EFL, if they were relegated.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I can recall doing a day trip from Brighton to Carlisle on train, and it's a fantastic town to visit. It's an old fashioned football ground which does make us legacy fans quite teary eyed.
It is a fantastic town to visit, but I was still slightly bemused by the fact that the last time we went there, it was definitely September when we left London, and it seemed to be January by the time we got to Carlisle. which was a shame because all I had on was a Joy Division T-shirt and a very light. I don't think I've ever been colder at a football match. I didn't know there were still things like Miss England going on, but now I'm really intrigued to find out whether Philip Day's daughter won it. I'm going to be distracted by that whole thing all the way through. I might have to Google it. This seems to happen on a regular basis, which is not good if you're a Southend fan, but the Shrimpers Trust have released a statement saying that Southend United chairman Ron Martin is not a fit and proper owner of the club.
Yes, we've always said appearing once on this podcast is actually can be quite a good thing.
Yep.
Appearing once a week or once once every couple of weeks tends to be a bad thing.
Yeah.
And yes, the relationship between the owner and the fans has fallen. And we're moving from one end of the country to the other here. Southend United are at the wrong end of a division, and this often is this often correlates with a breakdown in relations. They are subject to an embargo from the National League for late payment or non-payment of taxes to HMRC. So, I think the National League, who themselves have come in for a lot of criticism, some people will feel that is extremely well warranted. They do appear to be trying to monitor these things. Ron Martin is the owner. He's trying to move the club from Roots Hall to a more out of town location. I think it's called Fossett's Farm. I spoke to somebody in the game, and the subject of Ron came up, and he said, Ron has a habit of paying things late, to put it mildly. He wasn't therefore particularly surprised. He will probably pay the tax when he can feel about it, but he's also been subject to some other tax issues himself. Ron Martin's not been seen since the protests about his ownership have started at Roots Hall. In part of me thinks, well, would I, if I was a football club owner, would I turn up if people were going to be focusing on me and rather than team? So, this could be addressed via communication, and it's these same old things coming up again and again.
And it's not difficult to do either, is it? In this day and age, it's very easy to communicate with fans with something other than an open letter, which we know you don't like. It just sorts out all sorts of problems. Just have a chat with the fans. It's all the fans want, even if it's bad news. Just tell them it's bad news and what you plan to do to get out of it.
Just look at Andy Holt at Accrington.
He is the
personification of, you're not going to necessarily like what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it, and I'm going to explain why I'm saying it, and I'm going to look at the and if you focus on causes and consequences when engaging people in conversation. It's amazing how they will take a step back. The anger, which we associate with lots of conversation in a much broader sphere in society today, can be dissipated.
Mm. One of the things I love about doing this pod, Kieran, is that when you mention Andy Holt, people across the world, in every continent, will be listening to this going, oh, get a room. When is there going to be a pod where Kieran doesn't mention Andy Holt?
Well, I mean, the first time we had communication, we were each other's neck. We were each other's throats. It was, I'd queried something, and to be fair, the Accrington supporters put Andy. I'd queried something about the club, and the Accrington supporters put him in contact. And he was. I like him because he is honest. He is fair. And he will explain things. He won't give you a load of old codswallop either. He will be very direct and very accurate.
Yeah, he sounds a bit like Ali. That's more or less how we met, to be perfectly honest. Here's some good news for Uncle Terry. Millwall's latest accounts are out.
Yes, and I think this is another example of how we have become inoculated to what would be, under normal circumstances, a bit of a concern. Millwall lost £13 million in 2020-21. And I think those are actually quite good results. And that seems like a paradox. But Millwall in the last year before COVID, I think they lost £6 or £7 million. That was the third lowest losses in the Championship. And we're talking about a club losing a six-figure sum every week. And I'm saying, that's quite good.
Yeah.
And it does show just how normalized losses in football have become. And our very good friend, who although refuses to come on the show, Swiss Rambles, put out a fantastic thread on the losses in football over the last 10 years. Today, you know, we're recording this on Tuesday. And it does show that that football, from a business point of view, and we know that football is not a business to us, but at the same time, we want it to be sustainable. So therefore, you need to have some form of common business sense being applied. Those rules aren't being applied. Millwall are what I consider to be a well-run club. The owner, John Berylson, he puts money in on an annual basis. Millwall have lost £114 million over the years. You know, we're talking a ridiculous amount of money, and I'm saying that's good. I think he's a really good owner in the sense that he sets a sensible budget. He says, this is how much I'm prepared to fund the club this year, and they stick to it. And they've had to borrow from the EFL as well. They've and repay that over 3 years, so that's going to have an impact on them going forwards. But the loss of control over costs in the game, how long can that continue before we see more owners doing a Tony G and either running out of money or running out of interest, as we've seen at some other clubs.
Yeah. We're going to be speaking to someone from Clapton FC's women's team about this next story in the new year. But it's come to light, Kieran, just how big the gap is between prize money in the men and women's games in England, particularly in the FA Cup.
Yeah, we just had the FA Cup final take place. Was it well over 50,000 in attendance, and the winners got $25,000. Now that compares to 1.8 million for winning the men's competition, and that's after the Football Association halved the prize money for the men's competition in lieu of COVID and the impact that was having. So it's crazy. In the first round proper, you get £22,600 in the men's competition, £850 in the women's competition. And the reason why this has been, we're going to have a chat with our friends at Clapton, is they're a seventh tier club, and they've done fantastically well to get to the third round. And I think they were due to play Plymouth, or they're going to play Plymouth. And the crazy situation is that if they do get to play Plymouth, it's an away fixture, and they will make £1,250 from it. Now, to get from Clapton to Plymouth is a long journey. They're actually out of pocket, because by the time you've paid for the train fares, and if they are going down the night before, then it's lunacy. So whether this is something which should be addressed by the FA, or whether this should be addressed by an independent regulator. I don't really want to say.
Well, the FA need to address it, and in particular, they need to address why there's that disparity in the first place. If anybody from the FA is listening to this, and we know they are, we'd be really intrigued to hear how they justify those ludicrously small amounts, especially as we know that there is money coming into the women's game now through broadcast deals, etc.
Yeah, nobody's claiming that the women's game at present is generating the same type of broadcast revenue as the men's game, but that is reflected in the finances of clubs. But these particular gaps do seem to be crazy, and when we are seeing examples of national teams now paying the same amount for men's and women's, Lewis Football Club on last week, and they explained why, because it's still a 90-minute game for both men and women.
Well, and also you can't on the one hand bang the drum about saying we want women to play football, we want to grow this product, terrible word. And then on the other hand, give them no financial incentive to set up a team in the first place. That's ludicrous. So I would love to hear from the FA about somebody like that. I wish we'd recorded this bit before we did the Tracy Crouch interview, because I would have asked her about that as well. And I know what her answer would be. One final news story, Kieran. It's FIFA is looking at pursuing its own Global Nations League if plans to host a World Cup every 2 years fall through.
Yes, it does now seem that both UEFA and the South American football authorities are pretty united in their opposition to a World Cup taking place every 2 years. I think we've discussed this at length. There are pros and cons when you do look at it, but the existing fixture congestion could only be amplified, and this leaves FIFA with a problem, because ultimately it all comes down to money and politics. If FIFA aren't going to have money coming in once every 2 years, because effectively FIFA only make money once every 4 years under the present situation, because I can't remember who won the Confederations Cup or who won the FIFA Club World Cup most recently. And perhaps that makes me a bad fan. I don't know. But it doesn't seem to engage with an awful lot of people. But what FIFA have done is that they've seen that the Nations League, which, if we're honest, I think we were quite sniffy about to begin with, now does have a sort of a degree of interest, and it's a relatively small, short competition at the final stage, but it does attract broadcast interest, which of course generates money. Could they do this on a global basis? And if so, what are the benefits? Well, the benefits is it would generate more money. So some form of seeding competition could now come in. It won't be the World Cup. And I don't think it's there, just as we don't see the Nations League as a replacement for UEFA, but it could help to plug a gap in FIFA's finances, and perhaps it would be a good workaround, a good compromise from the present fallout that we have.
Kieran, if you don't have a Confederation Cup spreadsheet, then that tournament is dead to me. if it means nothing to you, it's not going to mean anything to the average football fan, Kieran, let's face it. It's interview time, Kieran, and football supporters welcomed the idea of a fan-led review into the game. Tracy Crouch, MP, conducted that review, spoke to many, many people in the game to do so, including you. The report is now out, and football supporters in general have welcomed the results. So we spoke to Tracy Crouch about the process and about some of the details that are in that review and about the possibility of it becoming law.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Tracy, thank you so much for joining us again. Before we start to talk details of your report, can you remind our listeners how the review came about and the sort of people you spoke to? And to avoid embarrassment, you can just say The Price of Football podcast. No need to specify which of us got invited to talk to you.
Well, thank you for having me again. I feel that shows some confidence in the fact that I didn't completely muck up the last interview. So the review was in the Conservative Party manifesto for the last general election. Because of actually what had happened at clubs like Bury and Macclesfield. Mm. But obviously then COVID struck, and so it had been delayed. And then the ESL happened, or attempted to happen, and government just basically got fed up with playing nicely, I think, and triggered the review. And then 6 months later, the report came out, and it was very much a review led by fans. Mm. We heard from 130 something odd, football club fan bases. We heard from supporters through a survey, 20,000 supporters through a survey. So I'm pretty confident that we managed to cover off fans of most clubs throughout the pyramid.
And the overwhelming response from the fan groups to the review has been one of welcome and relief, I would say. The Football Supporters Association, for example, called it a small step for government, but a giant leap for football fans. So you must be happy that the people it's kind of really aimed at understand it and get what you're trying to do with the review.
Well, I think, firstly, they welcome the review. I mean, I think they found it sort of kind of quite a cathartic exercise in many respects, that people were finally listening to them. Mm. And you know, some of the evidence that we took from fans, it was heartbreaking, actually. You know, we as an expert panel would come off calls with certain fan groups and just be like, oh gosh, you know, how awful, you know, the experience that they've had is just something that must never happen again. And so, you know, it was, I think that they really welcomed the opportunity to talk to somebody about the experience that they had in their football clubs, because, you know, let's remember that this is not about any other, this is not like any other product in our life. You know, if you're fed up with your bank, your building society, your energy supplier, whatever, you can switch. You can just, you know, move on. It's not the same with a football club. You sign up for life. And, you know, and when a football club goes bust or faces significant challenges, you know, it can impact not just you as a fan, but the whole community. And so, you know, I think it was really important for fans to participate in the review. And I'm obviously thrilled with their response to the recommendations.
Yeah, Kieran will tell you that it's normally banks and building societies that get fed up with me rather than the other way around. cathartic is a really interesting word, Tracy, because it actually came as quite a relief to me to hear the government say out loud that the money in football is unfairly distributed. Would you say that was the major concern of most of the people you spoke to, the unfair distribution of money in the game?
No, I think the main concern from fans was about ownership. Okay. It was very much about sort of kind of people who have been involved in their football clubs that they thought, you know, shouldn't necessarily be involved in their clubs, and had led them down the wrong path, or, you know, had been absolute rogues, and, you know, so I would say that was sort of kind of the main gripe. And then coupled with that would be about the lack of regulation within that. So, you know, when, for example, you know, evidence from Bury, and this, you know, this is well reported, they would go to the EFL with their concerns, and the EFL would say, you know, I'm sorry, this has nothing to do with us, we're just a competition organizer. And then so they'd go to the FA, and the FA would say, I'm sorry, we're not the regulator on this. And so they felt that they had nowhere to go. So that sort of kind of regulatory gap was coupled very much with around ownership and so on. And then obviously alongside that was around the financial regulation, that you could literally gamble with money you don't have in a football club. And that in turn put, you know, the future of clubs, as we've seen, in a perilous state.
Yeah, Kieran's been fighting that regulator corner for, well, forever, since we started the pod, basically, and we will be talking about that in more detail later on. In terms of ownership, I particularly like the idea of the key items of club heritage being protected, and the golden share idea for supporters that would give us some influence without having to be millionaires. But is there a fear that that would be the subject of constant legal action from club owners if that was implemented? You can't imagine the Glazers, for example, allowing that sort of thing to go unchallenged.
Well, you say that. Manchester United have already started the process of setting up a shadow board, in which, you know, we recommend that as one of the core recommendations about supporter engagement. So they will already start to put that in place. And the golden share sort of follows from that. Liverpool Football Club have already set up an engaged consult consent process with their supporters. So I don't think it is actually too far off the mark. And I think the thing is, the shadow board will be established so that all fan groups, you know, not just the Supporters Trust, but, you know, a whole host of fan groups within a club can see what the vision is for the club. They can discuss the commercial kind of side of things, and they can have that proper conversation with the main board. The golden share is a specific aspect around heritage items, which I hope is never used, because the review is quite prescriptive as to what it can be based on. So club colours, badge, competition, and so on. Well, you know, in the 40 6 years I've been following football, of which, you know, probably, you know, I don't know, 38 of them I've consciously had an understanding of it. You know, these are rare, very rare occasions that you would require a golden share vote.
Yeah, I suppose Cardiff is the biggest example, wouldn't it be? They're trying
and
to change
Hull Tigers.
Yeah, oh, of course. Oh, God, yeah. That shows how much has gone on since we first started the pod, because that was a big, big story at the start. There's a real focus, Tracy, on grassroots football in the review, which quite a few of the people reading it, especially in the Premier League, seem to have misunderstood the concept of fan-led review. Why are we talking about grassroots football? Well, that focus on grassroots football and the women's game as well, was that always going to be the case for you, Tracy, or did they become areas of concern as the review went ahead?
Both, I think, is the honest answer. I mean, you know, my heart is very much in grassroots football. Mm. I support a Premier League club. I give up money every year to have a season ticket to watch Spurs. you know, sort of kind of self-inflicted pain. But you know, I mean, I love my grassroots football. I love non-league football. I love kids football. I think, you know, that side of thing is something that we should continue to invest in, and I hope I did a little bit to contribute to that as sports minister. But I mean, I find that the Premier League's response to the idea of redistributing money to grassroots football really quite bizarre, not least because the transfer levy of which I proposed in the report was actually recommended by a Premier League club. I thought it was a rather good idea, to be perfectly honest with you. And I don't see why they shouldn't. It's where, you know, talent, particularly kids football, it's where talent begins.
Mm. I want to bring Kieran in a moment on the price of grassroots football, just exactly how much it costs to finance, because it's not a lot. But on the subject of the women's game, just in passing, there's been a little bit of furore this week about Charlton women's team being asked to revert to being called Charlton Ladies.
Oh, sorry, Charlton. Yeah, sorry. I thought we were talking about Chelsea in the...
No, we can talk about Chelsea if you would, but I'm just interested in what you think. It's nothing to do with finance, but it just seems to me a slightly backward step to suddenly ask Charlton's women to be called Charlton's Ladies again.
So, to be honest with you, I didn't really understand the debate. I'm not sort of kind of... somebody who sort of kind of is worried too much about the semantics, as long as they've got a women's team. And I understand that people are upset by it, and that's fine, you know. But to be honest with you, when Charlton were relegated, one of the first things that I think Michael Grade at the time did was get rid of the ladies team or
that's
the women's
true.
Team. You know, at least they have a squad that are playing football. So, you know... I don't really understand the difference between women and ladies, but perhaps that just makes me a bad feminist more than anything else.
Well, possibly, but I'll be perfectly honest with you. Guy was very keen for us to deal with this as a news story, and we thought as two middle-aged men it'd be much better to ask you for
and
a view.
I've completely that for Guy as well.
To be fair to Charlton as well, the name change has come from an owner that is financing the team properly, so that's the other side of that argument. What did you want to talk about Chelsea women as well?
Well, there's just this bizarre situation, isn't there, which has come to light where you had a pitch invader last week during the Champions League game. And actually, it turns out that the women's games are not covered by the same rules around designated matches as men's games. And therefore, it looks like that the man could not be arrested under the legislation because they're not part of the same legislation. So there's an opportunity here to close what is being classed as a loophole in the designated matches legislation, which I thought was quite interesting.
It is, yes. Kieran, on talking of grassroots football, as we often do, there's some, as I say, bemusement from the Premier League that we're talking about it in this report. But I mean, I'm guessing, Kieran, it's peanut. I mean, in order to properly fund grassroots football, we're talking about a fraction of the money that's in the game, aren't we?
Yes. I think the costs of running grassroots football have increased because a lot depends on how far do you want to go down the pyramid. But at Sunday League level, I think that is the responsibility of the Football Association rather than the Premier League. Mm. But as soon as we start to move into semi-professional and National League, the TV deals are worth peanuts. The Premier League has very excitedly just signed, and hats off to them. It's a fantastic product. Yeah, they've just signed an upgraded deal with the American broadcasters. Could they be a bit more generous in terms of distribution? There's no reason why not. I think it's really a case of how far do you want to go, and the accusations which have been made by the likes of Angus Kinnear and Karen Brady and so on is that we're going to move to some form of Maoist dystopian, everybody's on the same wage, and that simply isn't the case. You know, Tracy's produced a 162-page report. I've read every single word at least twice. There's nothing like that. I don't know where some of these comments are coming from. How grassroots football should be decided. It's a health issue. It's a mental health issue. It's something which gives enjoyment. Nobody's saying that it should be fully funded by the Premier League. Everybody knows that they should be paying their match subs. Just as I do when I go and play, five a side at the local gym. I think the reaction has been very weird.
I just think it just showed actually to me, Karen, that they hadn't read the report. For start, there's two things to this. First of all, the Premier League distributes funding from its broadcasting revenue down the pyramid. No one is asking for the Premier League to distribute more. Well, I say no one, lots of people are, but I'm not asking the Premier League to distribute more down the pyramid from its broadcasting revenue. What I'm asking is for Premier League clubs to fund or to put extra money into grassroots through a transfer levy on international and Premier League players. So this is not about the Premier League. This is about the clubs. Now, bearing in mind, post-COVID, when we had a season of no spectators, there was still £1 billion transfer window. I'm pretty sure that they could just afford a little bit of extra funding to go to, I don't know, the Football Foundation to invest in pitches, for example. And in the report, I didn't actually put a price on it. I gave two indications of what 10% and 5% could look like from a transfer levy and what that would fund in grassroots football. But to be perfectly honest with you, the Premier League could do this tomorrow. They could change it tomorrow. They could put a 3% levy on, for example, and say, right, it's all going into the Football Foundation and then it's done, right? And it's the proverbial 1-0 up, park the team bus in front of the goal, because then everyone would be like, well, okay, fine, right? Because I'm pretty sure that despite everything, come January, we're still going to see a huge transfer window. And I just think, you know, whatever, 3%, 5%, 7%, 10% of that going into grassroots football would actually make a significant difference in pitches, goals, facilities, you know, and so on. And I think given the fact that the Premier League scout around 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds and pop them into their academies, I think it's the least they can do to make sure that those kids are playing on decent pitches.
Yeah. Kieran and I have been joking about that somewhat hysterical reaction of some Premier League chairman and chief execs, because we both had this rather, we thought, hilarious the idea of you walking into a bar full of Tory MPs just having been compared to Chairman Mao, because there can't be many Tory MPs who have been compared to Chairman. Did that reaction surprise you? I mean, we spoke a little bit about the opposition to the transfer levy, but it seemed to me it was a hysterical overreaction from people, as you say, who didn't quite seem to understand what the point of the review was in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it was over the top, although I can tell you that people from other clubs, put it that way, have sort of kind of dismissed or distanced themselves from those comments. That, you know, to be honest with you, they found it particularly distasteful and not particularly helpful to the, you know, long-term argument around the future of football. I think Angus in particular, you know, is somebody who likes to be poetic in his match reports. And that's fine. He's at liberty to do that. But I don't think it's something that's particularly shared by the Leeds Supporters Trust as a view. And, you know, and I'm confident that fans overall think that the review is something that is worth endorsing. But the other thing is like, you know, all his match reports are online, right? So like 2 years ago, where they're in a totally different situation elsewhere in the pyramid, you'd be unsurprised to learn that Angus thought that parachute payments were an abomination, that they destroy competition and should be scrapped, and that funding should be redistributed down the pyramid. So just depends, I guess, which part of the pyramid you're in at the time of writing your match notes.
Well, I'm really pleased you raise that, because there is such an element of hypocrisy to some of the reaction, especially Leeds United, for example, who were, as Kieran will tell you, a financial basket case in the Championship, now happily ensconced in the Premier League and telling Championship clubs to get their house in order without the help of others. I mean, as you say, football fans aren't stupid. We remember these things. And we put the response from Leeds United in that context.
Yeah, totally. In the same way that Aston Villa, you know, whose chief exec went out on the day of the report to dismiss recommendations in the report and talk about the investment, you know, the £1 billion that the Premier League distributes down the pyramid and everything else, forgot to mention that half of that money goes on parachute payments, of which his club was once a recipient. So, you know, it's like, actually, yes, you do distribute £1.23 billion, I think it is, down the pyramid, of which £628 million goes to a handful of clubs. And then the others, the other 68 clubs or whatever, actually don't get that, you know, an extortionate amount of money.
Yeah, and Kieran, parachute payments is the one we can't solve, isn't it? There's no right answer to parachute payments, is there?
It is very complex. I mean, the EFL say they should be scrapped, but the EFL have parachute payments themselves, which appears to be a bit of an inconsistency. It's the gap between divisions that's the issue. If we can narrow that gap through some form of negotiation, people acting like adults, then parachute payments automatically disappear. It's the cliff that's the problem, not the parachute. And you know, the Premier League's an incredibly successful competition. It's a fantastic export. I don't think anybody wants to cut off at the knees those clubs that have been successful. At the same time, the desire to get there has led to somewhat lunatic behaviour in terms of the way that clubs behave, and you know, and we now have the tragic case of Derby County, who are in administration because the owner got bored of funding those losses, and there's a genuine chance that the club might not exist, and nobody's hoping it's going to come to that. And you know, HMRC are going to take a position, the club's going to take a position, the administrators are going to take a position, but it had been flagged. People just chose to ignore it.
Yeah, Tracy, of course, the other big issue for critics was that of the independent regulator, or as Steve Parish, chairman of my club, put it, government interference.
Which shows, Kevin, that actually he didn't read the report.
I couldn't agree more, unfortunately, because Steve Parish is an intelligent man, and I think if he had read the report, he'd agree with most of it. But were you surprised by that, I mean, vehement disapproval of the idea of an independent regulator? But then, of course, the EFL backed the idea. Were you surprised by that as well?
So, I mean, the frustrating thing about some of the comments about the independent regulator is, again, they haven't read the report, because they're calling it a government regulator. And I make it very, very clear in the report that it is not a government regulator. You know, it is appointed independent of government. So it won't be that the Prime Minister is, you know, wanting to appoint, I don't know, Paul Dacre. it is entirely independent of government. And that's the annoying thing, is that, you know, I go to great pains to sort of kind of show how this is not sort of kind of political interference. But anyway, The reaction from the Premier League is something that I'm not surprised about. They have at least been consistent. I'm talking about the Premier League, not necessarily Premier League clubs.
Yeah.
Because there are differences within Premier League clubs about an independent regulator. But the Premier League has consistently argued for an independent unit within the FA. Now, this makes me laugh a lot because the one thing the FA is not is independent, and therefore the vested interests still sort of kind of rule within the Football Association. So the idea that we as football fans are suddenly going to think, oh, yeah, no, that will work, right, is hilarious. And I kind of feel that they've completely misread the room on that. The EFL, I will be absolutely honest and upfront, they started off very much of a view that the independent regulator is not necessary. They want an independent unit in their own league. And in fact, I think they're still going to continue in setting up some sort of independent unit until an independent regulator is appointed. But they have realized which direction, you know, travel is going in. And they have been smart enough, in my view, to actually read the tea leaves in Parliament in Westminster, but also you know, the views of fans and of clubs, and have got on board, albeit, you know, hesitantly and not, you know, it's perhaps a bit reluctantly, but they've got on board with the idea of an independent regulator. So, you know, they've come on the journey, whereas I kind of feel that the Premier League and the FA haven't even got to the station yet. But the train has definitely left.
It's a shame. If Steve Parish, I'm sure he has read the review or somebody's read it on his behalf. That's how Steve tends to work a lot of the time. there is so much in it that I think he would have agreed with. I mean, Steve was the Premier League chairman who led the response of the other 14 clubs to the idea of a Super League. And he doesn't seem to have put two and two together with some of these things. An independent regulator would have probably headed the Super League idea off at the pass a long time ago, and he's talked about a fairer distribution of the money in football, and it's slightly disappointing that he's just gone for the headline as well. Speaking of which, I wish you hadn't said that about Paul Dacre, because I'm worried that producer Guy might try and use that as an exclusive. we might end up with a producer Guy tweet that's sent.
Yeah, let's not go down there, right?
Okay. No. Let's not go down that river.
If there is no news story from this podcast, then
that will
help enormously with the whole idea of moving forward on this and the recommendations.
There will be no news story on this podcast. And before we talk about moving forward, because we have time issues, I know that. Tracy, the one thing as well, I'm really keen to ask you, because even fans of the review, which we are, have wondered why there is no mention in there of states, foreign states, taking over football clubs, particularly with the Newcastle situation ongoing. Was that simply because you can't ask football not to deal with countries that the government has trade links with?
Well, there's two parts to that question. The first is that the Newcastle takeover happened towards the end of the review process. So, you know, we were taking lots of comments from fans of in Newcastle who were just desperately keen for transparency in a takeover process. And you know, I think this was going on for what, 4 years, and they were getting exceptionally frustrated and everything else. So from a fan perspective, which is obviously where we were at, they just wanted answers and they wanted a decision to be made. And then sort of kind of the decision happened when we had finished taking evidence from fan groups and we're in the process of writing up the recommendations. But there is an aspect of, you know, we do as a country, under all governments, not just us, but we do as a country trade with Saudi Arabia and other countries. And therefore it is, I, you know, I think there's legal issues as to whether or not you could stop them being involved. I don't know, because I'm not a lawyer, but I suspect it would be really difficult to say, well, you can't own a football club, but hey, here's a major stake in Disney, you know, run wild with Pocahontas. So it's like, I just kind of, you know, I find it slightly difficult to say that. But also, you know, where do we stop? Okay. Because we sit there saying Saudis have got a poor human rights record, and yes, they do. But we let a Chinese consortium run Wolves. You know, we've got Russians involved in Chelsea. We've got an Iranian involved in Everton. You know, so where? Well, actually, the Americans still have the death penalty. So, are we going to talk about their human rights record? I've been on many foreign trips where people berate us for our human rights record because we don't give prisoners the vote. So, you know, at which point do we start to say somebody's human rights record is so bad? You know, when there are varying views on our own human rights record.
Yeah, do you know, interestingly enough, we had a listener from Malaysia who pointed out recently when we were talking about human rights, et cetera, and Newcastle pointed out that when the World Cup took place in England in 1966, homosexuality was illegal, which is a thought. It never even crossed my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, again, two wrongs don't make a right, but it's an interesting point that sometimes we do need to look inwards as well as outwards.
I'm a great believer that sport solves everything, right? I literally show me a problem where sport isn't the answer. And, you know, I, as sports minister, was forced to go to Saudi Arabia to talk about women's sport. And I didn't want to go. I did absolutely everything I possibly could to get out of it. Including not telling my private office that my passport had run out. annoyingly, there's sort of kind of super efficient on these things. Anyway, I went and I played football with girls. Yeah. And I talked about why it was important to let women into stadia, why it was important to get women active, and so on. And do you know what? There was an article in the paper about 6 weeks ago, and I took a picture of it because it was just phenomenal, of a female national Saudi football player playing in the national stadium. And I thought, right, you know, they still hang people. But, you know, we've made a little bit of progress on women playing sport in Saudi Arabia. Mm. And I just think actually, you know, football can help address some of the issues around human rights and inequalities. Yes, I hate it and I feel uncomfortable, but, you know, let's use it as an opportunity.
I love that concept, and there's not a problem that sport can't solve, because there have been times walking away from Sellers Park when I think the sport has made it worse. As Kieran will know, I've been through a difficult time recently with bereavement or whatever, and then walking away from Sellers Park when we beat Everton 3-1 does add a spring to it. It does make a difference to your life. So you're absolutely right. Just finally, Tracy, the good news is it seems that there is the political will to do this, to follow through on the review. I noticed Julian Knight, who's the Department for Culture, Media and Sport Committee Chair, he said recently, there must be no further prevarication. We must look to introduce a football regulator in the next Queen's speech. We can't keep kicking this down the road. So, I mean, that's good news from your point of view. So do you think this will be passed into legislation? Do you think these things will happen and that the opposition will fall away?
So I'm heartened by the government's response to this. Both the Secretary of State and the Prime Minister did various clips. PM put something on Instagram saying that they support the main recommendation of the report. It wasn't nuanced. So he didn't say we support the main recommendation, but we'll consider, you know, the position on legislation. So I'm hopeful that there is something being done within Whitehall now to draw up legislation. I know for a fact that the Premier League are, you know, recruiting all the possible lawyers and economists and everybody else to dazzle civil servants with ways of preventing this from happening. So I would be severely disappointed if there wasn't something in the Queen's speech. But, you know, let's wait and see. I'm confident that government accepts that the main recommendation of independent regulator, and therefore everything else follows into it. It's not an a la carte menu. This is a holistic package of reform. And so, you know, fingers crossed, shall I say.
Good. Well, let's bring it right back to where we started and just say, at the very least, I really hope that you've been heartened and gladdened by the response of football fans groups, which has been unanimously positive as well. And they're the people that this was done for. So in that case, it's already been a success as far as we're concerned. So let's hope it can be made a formal success and some of these things are adopted without too much fuss from the people who normally make a fuss.
Yeah, well, no, thank you. And the fan groups have been amazing. They were amazing during the process. They've been amazing afterwards. You know, they need to let their MPs know that they support the review and its recommendations, so that their MPs know that, you know, that what the feeling is out there on the ground. So get writing emails and letters is all I say.
And of course, you spoke to the world's leading football finance expert as well, didn't you?
I did. And, you know, I thought that Dan Jones from Deloitte was amazing. And Kieran actually contributed a huge amount in terms of, you know, some of the technical stuff. And, you know, the smoothing around parachute payments is something that is not going to go away in terms of how do we, as he said earlier, how do we address the issue of the cliff edge, not just between Premier League and Championships, but also Championship to League One and League One to League Two. But also, you know, the technical stuff around capital and liquidity requirements for football clubs in the future. I mean, I keep on describing it as a really sexy recommendation, but it is only sexy if you're really into financial regulation, nerdy stuff. And I was amazed that I did get quite interested in it. It was very helpful. Thank you, Kieran.
We've lost Kieran for the rest of the day now. You started talking about sexy liquidation and capital. That's it. That's him gone, I'm afraid, Tracy. Tracy, thank you so much for talking to us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
I mean, she's great, Kieran. As you say, she takes every question properly on the chin. She doesn't avoid difficult answers, but she does sound a bit bemused still about the level of antipathy towards the report from people in the Premier League who she thinks probably haven't read it.
Well, yeah, there's if they had read it, you would have thought that their answers would have been a bit more nuanced and a little less populist in the nature of their replies. The report is progressive. It's as she said herself. Yeah, she's not demanding anything which is unreasonable. The Premier League is very successful, and she wants it to remain successful. Yeah, Tracy's a Spurs fan, so she's seen the benefits of the club growing on the back of a successful Premier League herself. The reaction from some owners, and I think it's very noticeable that the clubs which have been put forward, and clearly there's been a WhatsApp group meeting here. It's been Leeds, Villa, Palace, and so on.
Yeah.
The sneaky six who were behind Super League, they've kept their mouths firmly shut. And this is part of the process going forwards. As Tracy herself said, there's going to be an army of lobbyists and economists and accountants and lawyers poo-pooing any of the proposals which the Premier League itself doesn't like. The Premier League exists in this country because football exists, and football exists because of fans.
Why is such opposition to the transfer levy idea from Premier League clubs? And would that be a levy on profits from a transfer or on the actual transfer fee itself?
I think it's a levy on the fee itself. Now, this only applies to transfers from one Premier League club to another. So if the Premier League the Premier League club is looking to recruit players from, you know, Stoke, Sunderland, Derby, wherever it's going to be, there's no adjustment there, which is actually good because it prevents the Premier League clubs from saying, well, yeah, we were going to give you 20 million, but we've got to go and pay this 2 million, you know, 1 million pounds, whatever it's going to be. So therefore, we're going to take it off you. So it's only going to be between Premier League and Premier League, and also between Premier League and overseas deals. So again, that's good in a sense that there is a premium which encourages local development, and I'm not certain where the Premier League's response came in respect of this or those people that have been opposing it. We pay levies on many products that we buy. I've just written an article for a journal called Political Quarterly, whereby I've said, you know, my club Brighton, your club Palace, we generated more money than the likes of, I think it was Ajax and Inter last year.
Wow.
So you know, we are not disadvantaged as Premier League football clubs. And also the vast majority of the levy would be paid by the Sneaky Six, who make such huge additional sums compared to the rest of football that it is being borne by those with the broadest shoulders.
Yeah. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to our always free to air pod, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, our Monday show is all questions, then email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks again, folks, for feedback and reviews. It does help us on the business side, you know, and I'm contractually bound to say that because that's what producer guy says. And before he sends me any wonky chomps for Finlay for Christmas, he says just make sure you mention it. So if you can go on to that purple icon, and I've been told it's purple. I don't know what purple is, of course. For Apple or your podcast provider, and you could give us a review. You give us 5 stars, that would be fantastic. But don't think it's worth it. And it doesn't matter what you say, by the way, in terms of the narrative. It's the fact that you've given the review. So you could say it was. You'd rather have it hosted by Casey Jones, driver of the Cannonball Express,
ooh,
and Pauline Black, the lead singer of The Selector, and I think that would be an interesting combination.
Considering one of them's fictional, it would be really, really.
Oh, no, he's not. No, Casey Jones is real.
No.
Yeah.
Casey Jones steaming and rolling.
Steaming and rolling. Yeah, you never have to guess.
When you hear the tooting of the whistle, it's Casey at the throttle of the Cannonball Express.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that show is based on a real railroad pioneer who sadly died when he was run over by his own train.
Oh, well, that's the way to end the pod.
That's why there wasn't a second series.
Oh dear! I've learned a lot on this pod. Jan, I don't mean this to sound flippant, Kira, but you mentioning purple there, so your colour blindness just ruins Quality Street for you as well.
Yes, yeah, oh, I'd go on shape, not colour.
Oh my lord! I'm finding more and more stuff out about that terrible affliction every week. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will be back soon. And we will be announcing officially the quiz. Well, we can do it now. It's 7 o'clock next Tuesday, isn't it? The 21st, I believe.
Yep. Yeah, splendid.
Great. Yep. Okay.
Better write some questions.
Let's make that a date then. I'm sure producer Guy has his own view on when the quiz should be, but we've just decided it's 7 o'clock next Tuesday. Christmas quiz. See you there. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.